Good morning, and peace be with you. Welcome to the First Unitarian Church of Alton. My name is Robin Crane, and I welcome you into this community of hope and transcendence. Here, we seek wisdom beyond our own experience. Here, we open our loving minds to the mystery of wonder and the moral imagination. Here, we transcend the day-to-day of our lives to seek for truths both meaningful and sustaining. Here, we seek to offer a loving message that provides wholeness in a broken world. We are Unitarian Universalists. I offer my welcome to you, and in particular to those who are first-time visitors. We invite you to fill out one of the visitor cards that's found in the back of the gray hymnal in the pews, and either place it in the offering plate or give it to an usher. And we will then send you our church newsletter for the next 3 months and to let you know about the programs and activities going on here at the church. We are glad you are here, and we hope to see you again on future Sundays. We do have a nursery for infants and young children under the age of 4 years old, through those doors and to the left in the first room that's past the foyer. And at the front, we have a spirit chair, which includes activities for all ages. You are invited to go to the spirit chair at any time during the service to take an activity back to your seat. Children and youth are encouraged to attend religious education programs when we sing and bless our children and youth later in the service. We welcome everyone into this home of comfort, spirit, justice, and hope. Now, we do have some announcements. We would like to remind you that we do have a scent-free zone in our sanctuary during worship. If you are sensitive to chemical scents found in many personal care products, you are invited to seek refuge in those pews over here. We also request that you do not sit in that designated area unless you are free of chemical scents. Essential oils are usually fine, but most perfumes, colognes, and hair products are out. Now, on November 9th, the day after the presidential election, there will be a special evening vesper service of quiet healing. No matter the outcome of the election, people will need a place to be in community and process what we have been through. So mark your calendars for 6 p.m. on Wednesday, November 9th, here in this church. We also ask that you please turn off your cell phones during this service or set them to airplane mode, because the concentration of multiple signals from so many devices causes problems with the sound equipment. Thank you. Okay, another announcement or two. Phil Embry says that where's Phil? Right there in the front. Phil says that the Southwestern Illinois Hemerocallis, is that right? Hemerocallis Society has assorted daylily fans or plants that are available free to any good homes. So see Phil after church to choose yours. Any unchosen plants are going to go into the compost pile, and Phil says no guilt, but I'm not sure if that means no guilt on his part or no guilt on our part. Okay, another important announcement. In the Kate Worker room here is a poster of items needed for our fourth Saturday personal care distribution. We provide necessities which people on low incomes are not able to purchase through the government's Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP. Items such as toilet paper, I don't know how the government thinks we can do without that, but toilet paper, diapers, soap, toothpaste, deodorant, shampoo, razors, laundry supplies, and the like. Your contributions are absolutely essential to allow us to make these items available to those in need. A few detachable shopping lists are included with that poster so that you can tear them off and take them home with you as reminders about what is needed. You can buy a lot at the dollar type stores for not too much money. And we do have a huge supply of certain items. We've got to have the cleanest teeth in the state of Illinois because we have loads of toothpaste and toothbrushes, so please don't buy any more. But there are some things that are really in short supply, and the men particularly are interested in razors. By the way, an interesting tidbit, my little foreign students who helped out last month with the distribution commented on how clean-shaven all the men were. They were rather impressed by that. And they really did care about getting those razors that we had and were running out. Reverend Dawn has an announcement.
Actually, I'll have a couple of things. Hang on. Let's do the technical thing here.
There we go. First, I want to mention that yesterday in this space, we had a wonderful memorial service for Dick Evans, and Dee is with family this morning who are visiting from out of town. I think there's some shuttling of back and forth to the airport, but it was Dee wished to let people know that she really felt held and loved and was very blessed by the support she's received from First Unitarian Alton. The second announcement is in our order of service. Now this morning we're going to learn a new hymn, a new children's recessional, and so there's an insert in your order of service, which now see, to me this is a familiar tune, and I thought, and I've learned through hard experience that what is familiar to me is not always familiar to everyone else. And so I offered the insert with the music, because I know some people know how to read music, and we'll practice it a couple of times when we let sing the children out this morning. But in order to save paper, if you could either hold these out and put them in a basket, there's a basket at the front and a basket at the back, or just leave this part in the pew, and we'll pick them up so that we can use them again in the coming weeks so we don't have to keep printing them, okay? That would be super helpful. And we will begin our worship with a prelude from Robin. Thank you. I'd like to invite Paula LaFond up to light our chalice. And as Paula brings the flame forward, I would invite you to look in your order of service or up on the screen, and when the flame gets a little closer, we'll start. Flame working? I have matches. Interesting thing yesterday at Dee's service, we had, at Dick's service, we had several people who were not, had never been to a Unitarian Universalist service before, so we, had to explain, didn't have to, but it was lovely to explain the significance of the flaming chalice as a sign of comfort in times of resistance. And so now I invite you to join in our unison words for lighting the chalice. We gather this hour as a people of faith, who joys and sorrows, gifts and needs, this beacon of hope, a sign for our quest for truth and meaning in celebration of life we share together. We are together this morning in a community of like minds and like hearts, a gathering of seekers brought together not by creed, but by a common yearning for truth and meaning in this world. This is a congregation, like so many others, freely gathered, founded in reason and love to nurture and grow and healing within these walls and beyond them. This is a group of souls in the presence of the divine as we are every day, but today gathered to seek together, to share what we know, and what we long to understand in the hopes that we may grow together and create a beloved community. Come, let us worship together. I invite you now to stand, rise in body or spirit, and join in singing our first hymn, number 188, Come, Come, Whoever You Are. So our time for all ages this morning, I don't have a script, I don't have a story, but I want to have a conversation. This is Columbus Day weekend, and that has all different kinds of things to all different kinds of people. So I want to talk this morning about the difference between a store, a library, and a museum. So what happens at a store? What can you do at a store? Yeah? You can buy stuff, right? And what do you do with that stuff? You got a saw hand over here? No? No? Okay. When we buy stuff, we bring it home, and what? It's ours, right? We get to keep it. We can do what we want with it, paint it blue, whatever, right? What about a library? Okay.
We borrow
stuff, okay. What about, can you go to the library and do stuff? Like sometimes they have classes, right? You can go to the library and do stuff. But can you keep the stuff?
No
right, because that's there for everybody, right? But everybody can participate, and that's cool, right? Okay, what about a museum? Mm-hmm.
You walk around and look at their stuff.
look at their stuff, right. And an interesting thing, in a museum gift shop, right, there's a place where you can buy the stuff or buy the kind of like the stuff, right? And then you can bring that home and that's yours, right? But the original stuff stays there, right? And it stays there because it's sometimes fragile, it's very precious, and it's important that we are able to learn about things. And sometimes we don't get to take them home, and sometimes we don't get to actually get in there and monkey with them and play with them. They're just for us to appreciate without touching, which I remember in museums when I was little. This is a hands-in-your-pockets place, right? So on Columbus Day, it's a really complex kind of holiday because we understand the difference between a store, a library, and a museum, and the different ways we can engage with stuff. But in the late 15th century, you know, in 1492, right, Columbus, they were not perhaps as enlightened as we understand now. And the culture at that time was, if I go see something cool, and I happen to be European and have with me envoys of the king and the cross, that I get to take what I want and do with it what I want. And that included people. That included people. And so for my Italian friends who celebrate Columbus Day, it is a very different experience for my Native American friends who celebrate a very different time. And so it's a complex conversation, and it takes a lot of listening, and it takes a lot of willingness to be open. And we all make mistakes, and we all learn from them. But the night that, and this is one of those things, like I like to have a children's story that has a tidy answer, right? We can tie it up with a knot and a bow and send the kids off, and isn't that great? And this doesn't have one of those. This isn't one of those things that you can tie up with a bow and say, you know, oh, well, this is clearly a thing with a store, and this is clearly a thing with a library, and this is clearly a thing with a museum. You know, it all mixes together because we're in a complex culture with lots and lots of people. So, that said, we're going to learn this tune. Do we have somebody who can, wants to, is there anybody but me who knows this thing? Oh, come on. You do not want me to sing. It's a bad thing. Okay, is there anybody who can read music and is willing to give it a shot? Yes? We have a volunteer over here. Okay, you want to stand up and give us a shot? Now, can you run us through the melody? Just once, okay, and we listen to it, and then we'll come in. You can help us out. We'll come in on the second time through, okay? Okay. Okay, hold up. That was awesome for the first time through. That was really, really great. And I mean, it might be because I don't know how to teach people to sing things, but that was a lot of fun. I have seen this hymn, this little lullaby, wonderful piece, used to sing the children out in other congregations. And the way they do it is to, there are four verses to this thing, and we've got one and two. I have only ever seen, you know, like the national anthem, I only ever knew there was one, right? I only ever heard the first verse, and sometimes you sing that twice through. So I'm going to ask you, which would you prefer? Looking at the words, do you want to do the first verse twice through? Do you want to do first and second? Do you want to send us back to do homework to find the others and see if we like those? What are your thoughts? First one? Do it twice through?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
Yeah? Do that? Okay. So let's start from the top, and we'll do it twice through. I'll turn my microphone off so as not to break anything valuable technical equipment. Okay? Let's go. That was wonderful, thank you. And now the children can go to their RE classes. And again, I would ask, when you're done with these, leave them in the pews, leave them in the little bookshelfy thing there, and we will recycle them and use them next week.
Our lives are filled up, our hearts are warmed by the giving of time, talents, love, comfort, and our many other human resources. We each receive from this church the opportunity to explore meaning, purpose, and value in our lives. How does the financial contribution you make here reflect what you receive? How does our collective money transform those within and beyond our congregation's walls? This morning's offering will be most sincerely and gratefully received. May it be lovingly given. Please join in reciting the offering blessing together. To the work of the church, which is weaving a tapestry of love we call community, we dedicate ourselves and these our offerings. We now invite you to rise in body or spirit and join in singing our second hymn, We Would Be One. It is number 318 in your gray hymnal.
Whoops.
Aha!
What did I give you?
You gave me 128.
Okay. You know what? I did that wrong.
Okay.
128. We'll do that. We can do that. We can adjust. She's the one that has the music. That is our life. Rise in body or spirit, please.
Thank you.
each week we take time to recognize the joys and sorrows, the celebrations and the struggles of this community. You are invited to write joys and sorrows that you'd like to have read aloud in the black and white book that's placed over here at the front of the service, at the front of the sanctuary. There's nothing in there for today, but anytime you want to write something down, we will read it from the pulpit. For things on our hearts that we hold in silence, we recognize them by taking a stone or stones from the bowls as we enter, or from the bowl that's up here in front of the chancel. We allow the stones to bring us into awareness of those things that are most important in our life through thought or meditation. We then place them in the cleansing waters of this community, which includes a little bit of the water collected from our annual water communion. If you have joys, sorrows, celebrations, or struggles that you wish to recognize today, you are invited to come forward now in a ritual of joy and sorrow.
We have a special joy, a stone of joy. Mona and Paul Hebert welcome their granddaughter, Ramona Roxanne, to this world. Ramona was born on Friday, September 30th, at 28 weeks gestation, weighing 2 pounds, 2 ounces. Please say a prayer for her and the miracle of life and science that are conspiring to bring joy. Let us be in the spirit of prayer. Spirit of life, God, we know by many names and by no names, we offer into your care the joys and sorrows of people gathered here. We hold in our prayers this morning the people of Haiti and Cuba and all the Caribbean islands and southern Atlantic coastline of North America. Hurricane Matthew there has been downgraded finally, but is wreaking havoc and hurting many thousands of people. We offer prayers for victims and survivors of sexual assault and intimate partner violence. Our national political discourse is triggering many survivors with images and words that that are far too familiar. We pray that they are able to experience peace as they engage with our democratic process. We hold in our hearts the people affected by violence and terrorism all over the world, and those who seek refuge as refugees in places where they may not always find room at the inn. We pray for our elected leaders that they be guided by hearts filled with compassion for those who are most vulnerable in our society. In this time of campaigns and competition, we pray for rhetorical temperance, that the words and deeds of those who seek elected office demonstrate the best of humanity and inspire humble service. We pray for those who are distant from us, whether by geography, time, or conflict unresolved. And we pray for those who are sick and suffering, for those who would seek comfort and shelter, for those who thirst, whether for water, dignity, or justice. Amen.
This morning's reading comes to us from Anton Chekhov in a letter he wrote to his brother, painter Nikolai Chekhov, 130 years ago, in 1886. It was printed in a collection called Anton Chekhov, A Life in Letters. Chekhov writes, "Civilized people must, I believe, satisfy the following criteria. One, they respect human beings as individuals and are therefore always tolerant, gentle, courteous, and amenable. They do not create scenes over a hammer or a mislaid eraser. They do not make you feel they are conferring a great benefit on you when they live with you. And they don't make a scandal when they leave. Two, they have compassion for other people besides just beggars and cats. Their hearts suffer the pain of what is hidden to the naked eye. Three, they respect other people's property, and therefore they pay their debts. Four, they are not devious, and they fear lies as they fear fire. They don't tell lies, even in the most trivial matters. To lie to someone is to insult them, and the liar is diminished in the eyes of the person he lies to. Civilized people don't put on airs. They behave in the street as they would at home. They don't show off to impress their juniors. Five, they don't run themselves down in order to provoke the sympathy of others. They don't play on other people's heartstrings to be sighed over and cosseted. That sort of thing is just cheap striving for effects. It's vulgar, old hat, and false. Six, they are not vain. They don't waste time with the fake jewelry of hobnobbing with celebrities, being permitted to shake the hand of a drunken judicial orator, must have been a big deal in Russia at that time, or the exaggerated bonhomie of the first person they meet at the salon, being the life and soul of the bar. They regard phrases like, I am a representative of the press, the sort of thing one only hears from very minor journalists, as absurd. If they have done a brass farthing's work, they don't pass it off as if it were 100 rubles by swanking about with their portfolios. And they don't boast of being able to gain admission to places other people aren't allowed in. True talent always sits in the shade, mingles with the crowd, avoids the limelight. This is wonderful. As Krylov said, the empty barrel makes more noise than the full one. Seven, if they do possess talent, they value it. They take pride in it. They know they have a responsibility to exert a civilizing influence on others rather than aimlessly hanging out with them. And they are fastidious in their habits. 8, they work at developing their aesthetic sensibility. Civilized people don't simply obey their baser instincts. They require mens sana in corpore sano, a healthy mind in a healthy body. And so on, that's what civilized people are like. Reading Pickwick and learning a speech from Faust by heart is not enough if your aim is to become a truly civilized person and not to sink below the level of your surroundings.
Okay, so here's the deal. My plan this morning was to talk about Christopher Columbus, his mission, his agenda, the motives of his financiers, and some of the less glamorous bits of his life. I will touch on those seedy bits later, but for now, there is a more pressing matter at hand. On Friday, late Friday, the Washington Post released a video recording of the presidential nominee of one of the two major parties saying utterly, utterly lewd and disgusting things about women. The candidate described committing sexual assault, of forcing his physical attentions on women, and claiming that because he was famous, they let him do what he wanted. He used vulgar terms for women's bodies and described how he would put his hands on them without their consent. He also talked about trying to seduce a married woman who eventually turned him down and implied that she was the outlier in his experience. Now, predictably, the internet exploded and the candidate's party imploded. Former presidential candidates and former presidents across the political spectrum have denounced his words. Pundits and politicians have called for the candidate to abandon his run for the White House. By Saturday evening, the National Party had yanked all funding for operations promoting the top of the ticket. Stranding this alleged billionaire to either raise private money or use his own checkbook for the next 31 days of the campaign. If history is any indicator of the future, it's going to be an ugly, if entertaining, 31 days. For a short while on Saturday, the name of the vice presidential running mate disappeared from the official campaign website. Rumors swirled and constitutional scholars became sudden celebrities as they explained to various news outlets the details and intricacies of the American electoral process. The long and short of it boils down to this: unless a candidate dies or is rendered incapable through illness or accident to voluntarily withdraw from the race, the party cannot remove him from the ticket. There is no mechanism for buyer's remorse. The term caveat emptor has taken on grave significance. So it appears that the candidate for president has trouble with personal restraint and boundaries. I am sure many people are surprised. I do not understand that surprise, but I am sure there are some for whom this was a revelation. As I typed this sermon last night, more and more recordings were surfacing. Outtakes from reality television programs, audio tapes from when the candidate was mic'd up and the cameras were rolling. For technicians, it's just easier to let things record than it is to stop and start and stop and start all the time. So everything said on the set made it to tape or digital audio now. More evidence will undoubtedly emerge in the coming days and weeks, and perhaps even years. That is the way when a dam of secrecy cracks. First one, then another. Then a flood of truth pours forth in volumes that cannot be denied. Now, this is very different from ganging up and piling onto a victim. In this kind of instance, it is the powerless who begin to find their voices and supported by one another, even in the face of new and terrible treatment, they show up and tell the truth, name what has been done, and call for accountability. The candidate, of course, is reeling. He is embarrassed and upset, feeling attacked for behaving in a way that has been acceptable in the circles in which he operates. And make no mistake about it, in the circles where this candidate grew up, power, wealth, masculinity, and the privilege they provide permit behavior that can make polite society wince and look away. There was a time not so long ago when men were broadly understood to be entitled access, sexual access, to women's bodies for their own entertainment and pleasure. Less than 50 years ago, spousal rape was not even a thing addressed in the legal code. 100 years ago, white men could use women of color in any degrading and dehumanizing way they wanted, largely free of recompense. 150 years ago, just across the river, if a white man wanted to kill their enslaved person as punishment for some offense, real or conjured, they could do so without fear of punishment. Women and people of color were property, things to be owned and maintained in whatever way the master felt appropriate. Now, this culture did not spring fresh from the earth when our nation was founded. It did not arrive fully formed at the beginning of the Civil War, nor did it emerge as the trade in enslaved African people grew in the American South. The culture of treating some people different than others came to America by an Italian guy underwritten by the Spanish crown, who was desperately off course for his intended destination. And this is the weekend when the United States celebrates the efforts of Christopher Columbus, the last of a series of explorers to discover the North American continent, but the first to have the backing of both church and crown and their accompanying publicity machines. Columbus was sent west, across the ocean, for all the reasons explorers went anywhere in those days: to find riches and wealth and resources to exploit, to claim new lands for whatever government had hired him, and to navigate a shorter route to India and the traders located there. As a subtext of this agenda was a command and blessing by the church. At that time, there was only one, the Holy Catholic Church, steeped in the military conquest and expansionism culture of the Holy Roman Empire. The second order of the day was to civilize and convert to Christianity whatever kind of savage peoples they might encounter. And to that end, priests accompanied soldiers among the ship's companions. Any culture's foundational story plays a significant role in how that culture behaves and conducts itself. Let me tell you a story. When I was in seminary, I heard a woman speak who was, she was the head of the chaplaincy program at Mass General Hospital, Big Shot Hospital in Boston. And she told the story of origin of that hospital. And it was founded back in the day on an island in sort of a murky, swampy part of Boston. And the intent of that decision was to restrict access. If you could not afford to pay the boatman, you could not afford the services you could find there. It was a way to avoid providing charity care. And she said, that story of origin is in the foundational DNA of Mass General Hospital. And she said, if you don't think it affects how decisions are made to this day by the Board of Trustees, you are sorely mistaken. What happens in the beginning sets the tone for events that follow. Like a cast iron pan, systems carry with them the flavor of their birth story. If you season a new pan, a new cast iron pot, by cooking spicy chorizo sausage in it, okay? The things you cook in that pan for a long time will bear the hint of that spice. And so when Columbus arrived in this hemisphere, he carried with him more than just 90 moderately unhappy sailors and soldiers and priests. He brought a culture of imperialism and colonialism, of European and Christian exceptionalism and assumed superiority. People who were not Christians or European ancestry were simply considered to be less than human, animals even, and available like merchant goods for the consumption of men. When he arrived on Hispaniola, Columbus first made friends with the natives, then captured and enslaved them, bringing some back to Spain as gifts for Ferdinand and Isabella, his sponsors. In return for these gifts and his efforts to secure them property, the monarchs offered Columbus governorship of the island and its surrounding lands and a fancy title as Admiral of the Ocean Sea. Turns out he was really a bad governor of land and people and shortly faced mutinies and rebellions. He developed a penchant for killing and enslaving the island natives and was eventually shipped back to Spain to face charges in chains. Columbus came to this hemisphere with the idea of consuming what he found here, and that's what he did. Acquisition and exploitation was the charge he was given by his sponsors. That was his job. He brought back fruits and vegetables, musical instruments of the island people, their jewelry and their art, and as much of their culture as he thought could be sold in the royal courts of Spain. It is perhaps only slightly ironic that of all the things Columbus brought back with him from the Americas, it was probably the previously unknown strain of syphilis that decimated his crew and then great swaths of Europe around the turn of the 16th century. Eventually, it settled down into more of a chronic ailment that killed people slowly, but those first years were unpleasant. It is perhaps the only real punishment Spain ever experienced for its colonization of the New World. Now, my original thought when considering Columbus Day was to examine the ways in which Europeans have historically raided foreign cultures for their riches and art while doing profound violence to people of those cultures. This is a topic that often comes up in October when some celebrate Columbus Day and others Indigenous Peoples Day. And American children clamor for whatever is popular Halloween costume of the year. I remember as a child and as an unaware young adult dressing up for parties as a wide variety of culturally inappropriate things, ranging from a Native American person or a gypsy or some other marginalized group. I did not understand then how offensive those images and that behavior are to members of those groups. Today, I am more aware and I look back on those younger years and cringe at what I had done. I struggle with the urge to go find every person of color I know and apologize for my being an unthinking git when I was 17. White guilt is not particularly helpful to the work of justice, and it is not my friend's responsibility to make me feel better after I've behaved badly. That's my work. The best apology I can offer is to change my behavior and become a solid ally. And so we come to this European-based culture that treats the world like its own sort of grand flea market of cool things, where trinkets can be collected and riches exploited without regard for the people whose lives are involved. That's a broad brush, I get that. Not all people, I get it. And we look around us in 2016, and we see a 70-year-old rich white guy who views the world around him as his own personal buffet of pleasures to be consumed without regard for the human lives involved. Columbus didn't discover America. The Vikings were here first, and some other folks, and even another Italian explorer named Vespucci made the trip long before Columbus did. And he didn't prove the world was round. Galileo had started that rumor years before, and by the time the late 1400s rolled around, everybody sort of figured it was true. People didn't have a clear idea how big the planet was, so they thought it would take much less time to get around it. But still, Columbus didn't prove anything new. He didn't discover anything that hadn't already been reported. What happened was he got good publicity. He was friends with the people who wrote textbooks. He became popular really after the American Revolutionary War. He was lost to history before then. But what happened is after the Revolutionary War, America, these new Americans, these patriots, looked around and they're like, we need to compile our history and understand how we got where we are. And British explorers were kind of out of fashion at that time. And so they looked around and they're like, here's this guy that's got sort of a vague, fuzzy history. Nobody knows a whole lot about him. And they built this narrative around him. So America had a hero. It didn't matter that his biography was pure fiction, that his finances were a mess, and that he had failed at managing the riches his sponsor had given to him. He was a good story, as long as he didn't look too closely, and that worked for America. Good thing we're past all that, huh? Is this mic on? October is the month in which we explore integrity. What it means to us, how we embody it, how we live it in our lives. So far, it's been a really rough month for integrity in America. How do we embody integrity in a world that seems so devoted to be just the opposite? We do it the way we do anything. We do it one bite at a time, bit by bit, piece by piece, bird by bird, as Anne Lamott tells us Each day we get up and do what we can to speak the truth, even when it scares us. Each day we get up and work to be more aware of our own privileges in this world. Each day we get up and commit to listen more than we talk, to serve more than we demand, to give more than we receive. Integrity is not about being truthful on your resume. It's more than that. Integrity is what we do when we think nobody is watching. Integrity is how we behave when we are alone and there are no witnesses. Integrity is about how integrated our values are with how we behave in our everyday lives. And integrity is a spiritual practice. To be honest and fair, to be kind and generous, to be true to our word, to keep our promises, to keep confidences that are shared with us, speak up when we see injustice happening. All of these things are spiritual practices that we can engage in that make the world a better place. They cannot be done by any other means than one voice at a time, speaking up, raising up the truth, shining a light into the dark corners and bringing us all back to a place of wholeness and integrity. This is my prayer. May it be so. I would invite you now to rise in body or spirit and join in singing our final hymn, One More Step. It is number 168 in your gray hymnal. I invite you now to join in our unison words for extinguishing the chalice, printed in your order of service. We extinguish this flame, but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fire of commitment. These we carry in our hearts until we are together again. Let us go forth from this place refreshed in spirit, deepened in our conviction, inspired by our compassion to love and serve the world and its people. The service begins when the service ends. Go in peace.